This is Free Speech Radio News on June 19, 2003. From WBAI in New York City, I'm Amma Bouadi. People across the world are celebrating Women of Burma Day in honour of Burma's democratically elected Prime Minister, Aung San Suu Kyi, who turns 58 today. The Senate Commerce Committee votes to overturn parts of the FCC's media ruling, and we look at how communities in the South are commemorating Juneteenth. But first, these headlines.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israeli soldiers arrested as many as 15 settlers and found some 7 Molotov cocktails while dismantling a satellite Israeli settlement in Mitzpah Yitzhar, adjacent to the West Bank settlement of Yitzhar. Early in the day, settlers turned back soldiers attempting to take down the main tent located in the center of the outpost. While some settlers lay down in the road and place rocks in the way of advancing soldiers, others ignited Palestinian-owned wheat fields and olive groves near to the settlement. Sergio Yanni works with the Alternative Information Center.
Basically, in the occupied territories, there is a system of apartheid. Basically, if Palestinians were resisting in the same way that the settlers are resisting right now, they would have been shot.
The Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, reprimanded Iran today for failing to fully comply with inspection standards. Iran's President Khatami rejected allegations made by the U.S. while reasserting that Iran is entitled to receive international expertise to expand its atomic energy program. But as Pejmun Hagaji reports, despite the strong U.S. warning, easing domestic unrest in Iran seems to be first on the Islamic Republic's agenda.
Although the U.S. did not manage to get enough votes to pass a resolution against Iran in IAEA's Board of Governors meeting, Bush seized the opportunity to praise student demonstrators in Iran, saying that the United States stands squarely by their side. Having kept quiet throughout the past week, yesterday, Iran's reformist President Khatami criticized the U.S. of meddling in Iran's internal affairs by supporting unrest in Iran. Khatami said that despite our domestic issues, our people are united against any foreign influence.
Yes, we have some domestic issues. Having differences and problems is a sign of democracy. Yes, students have some legitimate complaints, but I believe if I asked the Iranian people to rally tomorrow, most of them would do so and would denounce any foreign influence in Iran.
Whether most Iranians would agree with Khatami or not, student demonstrations continued yesterday in Tehran and several cities across the country. Since his landslide victory into office in 1997, Khatami has been popular with students as a symbol of hope for change and reform. But this time around, instead of asking Dear Khatami to help, students are asking him to resign. For FSRN, I'm Pejman Hariri.
The House and Senate Intelligence Committees are holding closed-door hearings to determine whether or not the intelligence provided by the Bush administration in its push for war against Iraq was exaggerated. James Cullum reports from Washington.
Republican lawmakers rejected Democratic attempts to hold public inquiry hearings to determine whether or not the administration bolstered its case for war with faulty intelligence. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld says that pre-war intelligence was imperfect but good, angering many Democratic lawmakers like Congressman Gene Taylor, who says he was led to believe the administration's smoking gun theory because of the information provided for congressional analysis. In one instance, Iraq's alleged attempt to buy uranium oxide from Nigeria in the late 1990s was later proved false. This intelligence was also used by President Bush in his State of the Union address. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
The European Union summit in the Halkidiki Islands near Salonika, Greece, begins today. Ezgi Sertaj reports from Turkey.
The European Union summit opens tonight with a meeting about illegal immigration. 15 members of the Union and 10 new members are joining the summit. The meetings are seen as an important stage because of changes to the Constitution, which will be debated. Changes include a long-term European leader instead of one with a six-month term. As the meetings begin, 100,000 opponents to globalization also gathered in Salonika. Greek officials stated that they hope the summit will take place in a peaceful atmosphere. They welcomed the protesters and set up campsites 2 miles away from the meetings. 14,000 security workers are employed for the summit. Today there will be a solidarity demonstration with immigrants, and tomorrow a large demonstration is planned in Porto Karas. The protesters have identified Blair, Osmar and Berlusconi as the main targets of the demonstration. These are the leaders of the three countries that supported the U.S. invasion of Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ezgi Sertaj from Izmir, Turkey.
A state of emergency has been declared in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Hundreds of people have been in the streets throwing bricks, stones, and Molotov cocktails, and a 10 p.m. curfew is currently in place. The town of 11,000, which is 92% African American, has seen rioting in the streets for the last 3 days, following a police chase of a motorcycle that ended in the death of 28-year-old Terrence Shun. Witnesses say the police bumped up against Shun's motorcycle, which caused him to slide off the road. Many in the community are calling it another case of racist police department and years of frustration about economic disparity between whites and blacks. The unemployment level in Benton Harbor last year was 25%, while across the St. Joseph's River in a mostly white town, it was 2%. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The Senate Commerce Committee has voted to overturn parts of a Federal Communications Commission decision to allow greater consolidation in the media markets. The bill's fate in the full Senate is uncertain and faces a tougher time in the House. Josh Chaffin files this report from Capitol Hill.
The bill comes in response to a 3-2 party line vote earlier this month at the Republican-controlled Federal Communications Commission. In spite of having received hundreds of thousands of comments from consumer advocates, civil rights groups, unions, journalists, even the NRA, the FCC weakened the rules that are in place to promote diversity in the media and to keep a handful of big companies from controlling all the content. This morning in the Senate Commerce Committee, South Carolina Democrat Ernest Hollings came armed with statistics on what the new rules will mean.
One company could own VHF stations in every TV market in 38 states with the power to influence elections in 76 U.S. Senate races, 182 House races, 38 gubernatorial races, and 38 state legislatures, along with countless local races.
The FCC voted to raise the cap on what percentage of U.S. households one group of TV stations is allowed to reach, from 35% to 45%. The Senate Commerce Committee voted today to send out a bill that would reverse that decision. They also voted to reinstate the ban on TV newspaper cross-ownership, which in most markets keeps a paper and a TV station from being owned by the same company. Nevada Republican John Ensign argued that cross-ownership can have a positive effect on a community.
The Las Vegas Sun, which is the afternoon paper in Las Vegas, it's actually the more left-leaning, by far the more left-leaning newspaper, a couple of years ago started a local television station. Since that local television station started, we get so much better coverage of local issues, of the legislature, of the county commission, of the city council.
The bill that got out today would allow state regulators to recommend exemptions to the cross-ownership ban in small communities. It passed the Senate Commerce Committee with support from Democrats and from some conservative Republicans. A similar but more comprehensive bill will likely have a harder time in the House, where Commerce Committee Chair Billy Tozan has told colleagues to let the FCC decision stand. The bill's sponsor, Bernie Sanders, says momentum to move the Senate bill came from the people, and that the people will have to help him move the House bill.
750,000 Americans, progressives, moderates, conservatives, came together in communicating to the FCC that they did not want to see increased concentration of ownership in the media. Despite Mr. Tarzan's allegiance to corporate America and the big broadcasters, I think that if we can rally the American people, we can win this issue.
Media activists argue that if lawmakers are motivated to undo the FCC rules changes out of some fear for democracy, they're doing too little too late. John Schwartz is the president of Free Speech TV, which exists in a non-commercial band that's set aside to serve the public. Schwartz says Congress is being a little disingenuous in fighting the FCC this late in the game.
Congress itself significantly loosened ownership rules in 1996. With the 96 Telecom Act. Many of the same legislators that are now complaining and backtracking gave an awful lot of momentum to deregulation and consolidation at that time. That's when all the radio ownership limits were loosened so significantly, leading to the evolution of companies like Clear Channel.
Clear Channel owns more than 1,200 radio stations in the U.S. The fear is that unless Congress counteracts what the FCC did this month, TV and newspaper markets could start looking like the radio market, dominated by one company like Clear Channel. When a Clear Channel delegation came in early to the Senate Commerce Committee room this morning, one reporter asked, jokingly, if they were planning to take all the chairs. Josh Chaffin at the Capitol for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, on the birthday of Nobel Peace Prize winner and democratically elected Burmese political leader Aung San Suu Kyi, the Burmese military government stated that it took seriously the calls for her release, but was not prepared to say when she may be released from captivity, according to an Associated Press report. Meanwhile, people all over the world have been holding vigils for her safe release. The Burmese military government recently rearrested Suu Kyi for, quote, her own protection and will release her when tensions ease. She has now spent 7 birthdays in prison. Today, in honour of Suu Kyi's birthday, the people of Burma and people around the world are celebrating Women of Burma Day. FSRN correspondent Ingrid Drake reports from northern Thailand, where hundreds of women in exile from Burma are working for justice, peace and gender equality in their native land.
In 1988, Burma's government, the State Law and Order Restoration Council, consolidated its power by killing thousands of protesters during political demonstrations. Today, the ruling military junta continues to violently repress political dissidents, as well as terrorize its rural population through forced labor, relocation, and the systematic rape of ethnic minority women. While millions of people from Burma flee to neighboring Thailand, most of them have not been granted asylum, thereby classifying them as illegal migrants. Thailand, which is not a signatory on the UN High Commission on Refugees, has benefited greatly from this cheap and vulnerable labor source. Ying is from the Shan ethnic group, behind Burmese, as the largest ethnic population inside of Burma. She fled her village in the Shan state, located in eastern Burma, after her father was killed by the military in the early 1990s. Ying describes the conditions she faced working in a garment factory, or sweatshop, when she first arrived in Thailand.
To work in the factory in Thailand is very difficult and so dangerous because so many people from Burma come and work as illegal migrants, so that they have to worry about security. Someone will come and arrest them, and then also have to work for a long, long hour.
The difficulty of living in Thailand without her family and with the danger of being forced into the sex industry or domestic servitude prompted Ying and 30 other women to form the Shan Women's Action Network, or SWAN. The women created a network to provide material support and education for other illegal migrants. While there are other groups supporting refugees from Burma, SWAN focuses on leadership development of Shan women and preserving Shan language, food, and tradition. Ying describes how a women's empowerment training has given women along the Thai-Burma border the confidence and skills to work alongside men to rebuild the Shan state when Burma becomes democratic.
The first day the women came, they are very shy and they sit behind the elder people. We ask them to sit in a circle and encourage them to speak, everybody to speak and ask their experience and to be self-confident. So they really like about that and they ask to go back and have training again, and I'm so happy to see that.
Ma is from the Burmese ethnic group, which is also the ethnicity of Aung San Suu Kyi and the ruling government. Ma works with Women's League of Burma in northern Thailand, a coalition of women's groups like SWAN that work together to oust the Burmese military regime. Ma says, even as exiles from Burma work towards a democratic Burma, these women face the challenge of working with their male counterparts.
Up to now, even when women are involved, many men in our movement continue to say that this is not the time to talk about women's rights yet. You know, talk about it when democracy returns. Our main enemy is the SPDC. Get rid of that first. Then we'll talk about women's rights. We said no. You know, so what happened is that means we have like more than double, triple burden on our shoulders. Working for our rights, working for the gender equality within the movement, and trying to catch up with the political developments and trying to participate in the political, mainstream political movement, while trying to solve some other problems that our women are facing, like the trafficking of women, HIV/AIDS, health.
Over the years, organizations such as SWAN and Women's League of Burma have networked with women's organizations around the world, including those from Guatemala and the Philippines. Many of the women from Burma have become politicized and rejected aspects of their culture that place the value of women below men. Ma says that the fight for a democratic Burma goes hand in hand with freedom for all people.
The country we envision for Burma is a country where not only the end of war, civil war, what we see as the genuine federal future democratic Burma is where gender part is also included in the constitution, protected, and that women feel safe not only in the states, also at home.
The U.S. government has joined nations around the world to criticize the State Law and Order Restoration Council for its recent violent crackdown and detention of Aung San Suu Kyi. Organizations like Free Burma Coalition and Earth Rights International are continuing to pressure businesses to divest from Burma. The California-based Unocal Corporation is currently being charged with complicity in Burmese human rights violation in a landmark case brought under the Alien Tort Claims Act. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. To listen to this newscast or archives of previous shows, visit www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Across the United States today, celebrations are marking the declaration of the end of slavery for African Americans in the Southwest. News of the Emancipation Proclamation made by President Abraham Lincoln following the Civil War first reached Galveston, Texas on June 19, 1865. That's 2.5 years after it had been issued. This historic event was first celebrated in only rural areas where people of color owned land, but now the holiday is officially recognized by the state of Texas, and people across the state are celebrating in different ways. Richard Hanna has more from Houston.
Throughout the United States, Juneteenth commemorates the achievements of freedom for African Americans in the Southwest, much like the nation's Independence Day commemorated on the 4th of July.
138 years ago, General Gordon Granger announced in Galveston that those persons held in slavery were then free.
Professor Howard Jones coordinated this year's Juneteenth Academic Forum at Texas Southern University. For those whose families have celebrated the holiday for decades, Juneteenth brings back fond memories. Forum panelist and retired political science professor Dr. Gerald Prestige celebrated the holiday in Louisiana.
When I was young, and my parents and we would go and fish and just barbecue and talk about the 19th of June and getting the word that slavery was over. And my parents, who were both from Alabama, and especially my daddy, used to talk about how they celebrated. My father was born in 1894, so his parents pretty much had a pretty good grip on what the slave experience had been like.
Many in the African American community feel the oppressive history of human bondage in the past still has a strong relevance to the present struggles for justice and equality. This includes groups like the National Black United Front, who argue African American people are still not free.
We still find mass incarceration of African people, economic discrimination, inability to get housing, vestiges of the same things that existed in society over 100 years ago.
In the shadows of downtown Houston today, Chairman Kofi Taharka, with the Houston chapter of the National Black United Front, led a Juneteenth commemoration in a historically African-American cemetery. The over 350 ancestors buried in the cemetery were nearly forgotten when they were moved to a new resting place with only numbers to mark their graves.
We used our ancestral burial ground, a sacred ground, to try to commemorate Juneteenth as opposed to celebrate Juneteenth and to call attention to the fact and acknowledge that these ancestors are here, number one, because they're unknown. If you roll past, you wouldn't know what this was, you wouldn't know who they are. So we wanted to bring the community out and show that we recognize and respect them, that we acknowledge them, and that we believe it helps bolsters us in our righteous demand for full and complete reparations.
Today's ancestral ceremony demonstrates a shift away from the barbecues and family get-togethers that traditionally mark Juneteenth. Texas Southern University student Nakisha Sanders links the holiday to the issue of African-American reparations.
The celebration of Juneteenth shows the reality of what Africans went through in America. And reparations shows that there is a debt that is owed to the African community, whether it be monetary, whether it be in institutions, or whether it be in the freedom of political prisoners. I mean, it shows that there was some injustice done to us because people like to forget that. I mean, even as African people, we like to forget that because it's just a very hard pill to swallow. To really realize that you were enslaved, it angers you. It angers you. So you want to forget about it. So I think the people here today are really coming together to remember this.
While more traditional Juneteenth celebrations take place this weekend with the usual barbecues and red pop, members of the local reparations action committees will travel from cities throughout the United States to Dallas for the annual convention of the National Coalition for Blacks for Reparations in America. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Richard Hanna for Free Speech Radio News.
As the Senate gears up for hearings on the Healthy Forest Initiative next week, forest activists are taking to the woods to get training in nonviolent direct action. One such initiative is the Buckeye Forest Council's regional camp in Ohio, and another is a Threatened Forest, Threatened Freedoms camp run by Greenpeace in western Montana. Lee Rabatis talked with organizers of the Greenpeace camp and files this report from Missoula, Montana.
If passed, the Healthy Forest Initiative will speed up and in some cases eliminate public participation and appeals on timber sales done in the name of forest thinning and fire suppression.
We're being taken out of these processes, and so we're having to resort to direct action, nonviolent direct action, to protect these places that we so much love and cherish.
Greenpeace forest campaigner Ginger Cassidy says the Threatened Forests, Threatened Freedoms camp is a permitted gathering starting Sunday on public land in Montana's Bitterroot National Forest. The Bitterroot, part of one of the largest intact ecosystems in the Rockies, has been a lightning rod for controversy since management began large-scale harvesting after huge wildfires in 2000. Cassidy says the camp's purpose is to educate, empower, and inspire activists to protect public lands.
Part of those tactics are organizing skills, how to work with the media, and also nonviolent direct action skills like blockades, doing tree sits, and things like that.
About 40 trainers will work with an expected 80 activists. Two Earth First co-founders will be in attendance. One of them, Mike Rozelle, who's now working for Greenpeace, says direct action is not always necessary.
What's important is the public participation process. And when that is exhausted and the log trucks are getting ready to roll, the bulldozers are coming in, you really don't have very many choices at that point. You can go home and say, well, we lost this one, or we can say, no, not yet.
Greenpeace organizer Matt Stenbridge notes the Forest Service was founded by Teddy Roosevelt a century ago to protect lands from the robber barons at the time.
Somehow, those robber barons have just taken different names and different forms, and we still have them around today.
To Stenbridge, the camp is part of several decades of forest civil disobedience that seeks to protect the half of national forest land that still hasn't been logged, roaded, mined, or developed.
We're on the brink of having the U.S. Forest Service, because the Bush administration, go into our last wildlands and continue to degrade places where they've been before in an attempt to continue to feed these greedy robber barons.
West Fork District Ranger Dave Campbell, who oversees the area where the camp will set up, says only forest law enforcement and county sheriffs will have a role in monitoring activities around the camp. Campbell says the forest has gotten a number of complaints from locals who want the activist camp's permit revoked.
Some people of opposite points of view have said they wanted to have an altercation, which we said, you know, that there's no sense in that, and they will end up being the losers in that situation if they try to incite something. We just won't think we've been trying to tell folks to remember that it's a free country, and just as they have the right to their opinion, so these folks have the right to theirs.
When asked, Campbell said he's unaware of any additional powers under the USA Patriot Act that law enforcement might use against activists training in actions that might be illegal under different circumstances. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Missoula, Montana.
Reports of more protesters setting themselves on fire continue to dominate international headlines. According to reports, an exiled Iranian political leader doused himself in petrol and lit a match in the heart of Paris. An Iranian man and woman also set themselves alight just hours apart outside the French embassy in London, and Swiss police stopped a man in Bern from doing exactly the same. This, as Le Bourget Air Show, the world's largest meeting of aerospace industry leaders, enters its sixth day. The event, which ends on Sunday, was marked by the grounding of the Franco-British supersonic airliner Concorde. However, observers note that defense ministries of industrialized nations are increasingly interested in drones, unmanned aerial vehicles used for spying, combat, and civilian purposes. In the US, calls by congressmen to boycott the event fell on deaf ears, but tensions between the US and France has been reflected in how low the US turnout was at the event. FSRN's Nick Champeau reports on the downscaled US presence at the exhibition.
You don't see many American planes in the sky over Le Bourget, and this says a lot because it's an air show after all. That was a plane, but no, it was an Airbus A340-600. By the way, French Transport Minister Gilles de Robien today said that he was delighted that the European aircraft maker was moving comfortably ahead of its American competitor, Boeing. Anyway, let's have a look at the Bourget sky again. Now that's the French Rafale fighter plane. American military aircraft aren't flying this year at Le Bourget. It has never happened before. No point trying to speak to a U.S. general. The U.S. Department of Defense did not send anyone above the rank of colonel. U.S. officials from the Department of Defense said that with thousands of soldiers still in the field, there was no need to send them to the Paris Bourget air show. They also explained that the cutbacks are a result of the industry's economic slump rather than the transatlantic rift. The show's organizer, Yves Bonnet, insists that U.S. companies still represent 20% of the show's 1,700 exhibitors.
If you want, you can find a lot of Americans here. For the planes, it's true that the military one does not fly. The U.S. DOD told us that their plane will not fly without other explanations. It's their decision. I have no to comment this decision.
Senior executives for the U.S. company Lockheed Martin did not miss the opportunity to develop partnerships for their F-35 Joint Striker fighter program. Five European Union member states, Britain, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, and Denmark, have agreed to spend 5 billion euros for the plane's development over a period of 10 years. This amounts to half of the European Union's military research budget. This partnership illustrates Europe's failure to have its own defense capability, a project dear to French President Jacques Chirac. Tom Burbage is the Lockheed Martin executive manager for the F-35 JSF program. He says the industries of EU nations taking part are getting their share of the project, and he doesn't see why their input frustrates EU plans, because EU member states all belong to the transatlantic alliance.
It's a good thing we don't fight wars because of politics. Okay, we generally operate military equipment, and we band together in coalitions to prosecute, maintain the peace, or prosecute war if we have to. And you do that most effectively if the allied coalition can operate similar or identical equipment. Today, we don't do that. So by encouraging this investment in the Joint Strike Fighter, the U.S. is, in essence, helping to develop a platform that can be used by coalition air forces that can operate together at a much lower cost to preserve peace going forward in the future.
The problem is that on occasions, members of the alliance fail to reach consensus as to how peace should be preserved. Paris, Nick Champeau, Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Amma Bouadi, and you were listening to Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Katamesta, Simba Rousseau, with Aaron Glantz. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Josh Chaffin. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, and Lindsay Benedict. We also have technical assistance from our intern, Bob Stern.